welcome to episode number 83 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is Scott Gell of jQuery, Filament Group, and other fame. Scott, say
hey,
hi.
Hey, Jeffrey.
How
hey,
are you?
Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Pleasure. Scott, before we start, I have a lot of questions for you, but first I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor today is lynda.com. You can learn it at lynda.com, an online learning company with more than 77,000 video tutorials, Scott. 77,000, can you imagine?
Wow. They've been around a while.
Yeah, they've been around a very long while. Membership starts at $25 a month and provides unlimited 24/7 access to top quality video courses taught by expert instructors with real world experience. Learn anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace, from bite-sized tutorials to comprehensive courses in web design, development, business, photography, audio and video, 3D and animation. Sharpen your skills in CSS, JavaScript, and jQuery, Scott.
Ooh.
jQuery.
Fancy.
HTML, UX, and content strategy. Stay current with the modern best practices, with new courses added every week. That's more often than I get this podcast out. They're adding a whole class every time. Every time I do a podcast, they've added another course.
Wow.
The lynda.com library keeps pace with today's fast-changing technical and software skills. Save and prioritize courses in your queue for whenever you're ready to watch. Learn on the go with their optimized mobile site or free iPhone and iPad app for members. Try lynda.com free for 7 days by visiting lynda.com/bigwebshow. That's the most important part, so I want to say that again. It's free for a week, so try it for a week. Lynda.com, lynda.com/bigwebshow. That's how to get a free big web show, all one word. I know Lynda a little bit. I've met her a few times. Yeah, she's awesome. I'll tell you something. She's made this like from nothing, just from her own brilliance. She's built this empire. It's amazing to me. And I'll tell you a little known fact, which she told me the last time I saw her.
Yeah,
she used her college boyfriend was Matt Groening.
Wow, really?
Yeah, creator of Futurama and The Simpsons. Huh. So, if for no other reason, if you don't care about CSS, JavaScript, jQuery, HTML, UX, and content strategy,
subscribe anyway,
because she was too cool for Matt Groening. I mean, come on.
I remember the Lynda stuff when I was in school. It's been around a long time.
Don't you?
It's a good resource then. Yeah.
And still is. I remember her first books. I think you were like a baby. But I remember... do you remember the like designing web graphics? Did you ever see that? Yeah.
I don't remember the title in particular. I'll give you that.
Do you remember the abstract paintings on the cover of all our books that her husband Bruce did? I
that part is familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. She created that brand from scratch.
It's impressive.
It is impressive. I think it's very impressive.
And still going strong. That's great.
So speaking of going strong, so you're, I don't know, in your late 20s? Not even late 20s.
Yeah, I'm 30.
You're 30?
I am. Yeah.
Okay. You look younger.
Oh, thank you.
Devilishly handsome. World traveler. Author of the book Designing with Progressive Enhancement.
Co-author.
Web designer and developer at Filament Group, a smart studio that creates sites and applications for a wide range of clients. A couple of years ago, you got very famous for having worked on the Boston Globe responsive web design.
We did, yeah. We did the front end development, teamed up with another studio in Boston called Upstatement, who were sort of alumnus of the Boston Globe themselves. And they handled the design and we handled the front end development. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of interplay between the two, especially in a site like that.
Right, because at the time there were no techniques for, you know.
Yeah, quite a lot of the problems we ran into were, at least we hadn't encountered them before. So it felt like we were inventing ourselves a way of out of a lot of traps, I guess.
It was like an epic, I would think, because everyone knows how to do a fixed width, you know, the way we used to work, or the way a lot of us used to work. Here's the Photoshop comp. We've decided that the width is 800 pixels. Here's right. what it looks like.
Right.
What's going to happen down there? I don't know. That's below the fold. We don't care about that. Blah, blah, blah. And right. now you know, so use some pixel values and make this happen. And you guys were really, did they come to you? Did Ethan bring them? How did that all work, by the way?
Yeah, well, that started out, I think Upstatement was actually sort of on the job before we even came on. And I believe it all started, at least our involvement started when some of the members of the Globe development team attended a talk that Todd Parker, one of the partners at Filament Group, and I were giving at a local meetup. I think we were talking about progressive enhancement at the time. And so when they finally came to us in person and talked about the project, they were all already sort of pre-sold on the concepts, which was nice because, you know, it really allowed us to innovate in the areas that we cared about. So.
Which you've continued to do now for the 2 or 3 years since.
Well, we're trying.
Lately, you're talking a lot about responsive design. That's been your kind of your
sort of my shtick at the if you're conferences in the last year or so.
So is responsive design irresponsible? What exactly are you fixing?
Not at all. Actually, I think responsive design is very responsible from a visual design perspective on its own. So it's more about the approaches, the methodologies, the techniques that we pair with responsive design that need to sort of become more responsive.
The under the hood stuff.
How we're requesting files, how we're deciding, you know, which assets should be loaded in a particular environment and not another, making sure we're not just sort of applying all of our designs that should apply to one, or applying one design, one breakpoint's design to another when maybe it's not appropriate.
How many HTTP requests is too many?
Man, I don't know if there's a rule, but I think, you know, people have been talking lately about sort of a cap or a budget on file size, things like that. I think it really varies depending on the project, but
like a financial idea. Budget, but
yeah,
a code budget.
I'm not sure I have I know I don't have any formula that that pairs with that, but I think it's a good mind frame to.
Who, like Jeremy Keith has been talking about that, I think.
Yeah, Jeremy mentioned it, Brad Frost. I'm not sure. Maybe it was Tim Cadleck who first.
What a great name.
Brought up the idea.
I don't know Tim.
Tim of Breaking Development Conference.
Wow.
And
I should know Tim.
Yeah, I think he's broken off now. He's doing some consulting work, but yeah,
he broke off.
He ran the conference for a couple of years.
So he broke the Breaking Development Conference and then he broke off from it.
Breaking Development. Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this. We used to, there was a period where we would have multiple, you know, before we were doing media queries, when we were doing, browser, when we had so many bad browsers out there, and we would make like, well, here's our IE6 style sheet. There was a fashion for a while where designers were separating out their style sheets into different, you know, into different files.
Sure.
Today's multi-device world, media queries world, responsive design. Is this generally good practice, or is it better to...
Well, I think if we're still talking about old versions of Internet Explorer, then, you know, if they're on our radar for support, then there's probably still a little of that style sheet.
Let's say they're not
at IE. Okay.
Let's say they're not. IE 10 is now the default for most Windows users. That just happened.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, people are starting to think out of necessity, really, starting to think about differentiating based on features instead of the particular browser. Where features are shared across different browsers and different types of devices in many different ways. So making decisions based on a particular browser, You know, it's not as granular, I think, than we need anymore.
Right. But the point was really, there was this fashion for having multiple style sheets instead of one style sheet with multiple rules. What do we think about that these days in the multi-device world? Do we give different style sheets to different capability clusters, if you will?
Yeah. I think current practice or current best practice is probably to try and compress and deliver all of the possible styles in as few requests as possible.
So one file, even if that file has a lot of bytes in it.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. On the upside, CSS happens to compress very well. We use this transfer protocol called GZIP, right? Mm-hmm. And GZIP works particularly well. It sort of capitalizes on redundancy and repetition within text. So, you know, CSS has a lot of that. You know, margin, padding, we keep saying these same things over and over. So at least that's playing in our favor, right? When we're sending perhaps more CSS than a particular device needs. But I hope that down the road we'll have better tools in place for separating things out and loading only applicable CSS in a given environment. But I don't know. Right now, I think it's difficult to do it with CSS as opposed to JavaScript. It's kind of there are really nice tools that we already have for dividing things up that way. CSS is just hard.
Why? And yet, JavaScript is really what people are afraid of. Why are so many designers who are willing to do very difficult things with CSS, but who are frightened of JavaScript? Why is JavaScript so frightening to so many people? Or put another way, same question, put another way, why is jQuery so popular?
Well, I think JavaScript started off a little rough around the edges, right? And it was it sort of required this approach that, you know, you had to write JavaScript differently to work in different environments. And it's very, very different from at least the dream of, well, CSS and JavaScript these days of writing something one way and making it work across all of the platforms. But JavaScript was particularly tricky and even hacky to do well early on, right? And I think we're seeing, you know, with jQuery, it was this normalized, you know, write it one way sort of approach that, you know, it's very attractive. It's very attractive to
me. Ruby on Rails. Right. Yeah. Like this thing is all configured. Here's 15 things we know people like to do. We've done them for you. Plug it in.
Right. Unfortunately, I think lately JavaScript is becoming more and more normalized on its own natively. We're seeing browser support for many of the things that jQuery sort of evangelized and introduced us to, becoming very easy to do without a library at all. So it's still tricky. I think it's not quite there. If you really want to write JavaScript that works very, very broadly, there's probably going to be some workarounds still, but yeah, I think it's getting better and better. And as a result, jQuery is, becoming smaller, right? It doesn't need to provide so many workarounds.
Small is good because we don't know the bandwidth.
Fewer bytes, right. Sure. Right. Yeah, and also, you know, people talk a lot about the physical size of the bytes that are going over the network, but it's also a memory thing. Once that that file lands on the device, it needs to be parsed, and once that happens, you have to worry about how much memory it's consuming on the device, especially mobile devices. So that becomes a second level of performance concern, right?
Do you remember the old, by old, I mean last year's Facebook app? It was really a web, it was HTML app, things took forever, not because Facebook had bad servers, they have great servers, but because the little browser inside the little phone and with a little computer was trying so hard to figure out, right, all these layers of...
Right. And their sort of famous solution was to switch to native and solve all of the problems.
But, yeah, why did that bother you?
Uh, I'm not sure it really did bother me so much. I think they made some pretty broad statements about about whether or not HTML and JavaScript and those technologies are really ready for their sort of use case. And, you know, maybe their use case was a little different than most of us. But I think there were a lot of people arguing that, you know, maybe it was the implementation at fault rather than the technology.
I think it was if you send Robert De Niro to play a leading lady and he mm-hmm. fails, then say, well, see, there's no good parts for women. No, that's not really the takeaway. The takeaway is
yes.
Robert De Niro is a great actor, but shouldn't have been cast as the leading lady because that's not, right. you know, so they right. were doing things I don't think they needed to do.
Sure.
Or I don't, yeah. as a user, I didn't want them to do those things. They were like very concerned with replicating the desktop experience on my little mm-hmm. phone, and multi-device design teaches us that we don't need to do that.
You know? Right. So their right. priorities were a little different than yours, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it was a brand priority, not a user right. experience right. priority.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's unfortunate. We're seeing a lot of discussions these days around tools being at fault for a particular application being successful or not, when really it's, you know, it's more likely that the application of those tools was, you know, the success or the failure, right?
A gentleman yesterday on Twitter said, you know, responsive design is killing the creativity in
yes,
web design.
This got a lot of buzz.
It did.
Yeah.
Which seems to come off from your statement of, you know, blaming tools for,
I guess, you know, we are certainly seeing, we were talking a lot internally yesterday about this definite trend that we're seeing in interface design, just UI design in general of, you know, whether you call it flat or sort of digital looking, there's certainly some sort of, you know, aesthetic that comes with the Windows and Android sort of native look that, you know, I could see where you might call that flat or something compared to iOS.
Right. It's a reaction against the last 5 years of OS X and
sure.
all these little beveled edges.
Yeah. I think it's, for me, it's a stretch to relate that in particular to responsive design necessarily, but
yeah. Why? I didn't see that connection at all. Who made that connection?
Well, the quote, right?
is that what it's Noah, right? Is that
yeah. What? I think the quote was something along those. I'd have to pull it up, but that responsive design is something about killing the soul in our design.
They said that about blogging.
Sure.
They said that about content management systems. They said the grid. People said that about the grid. We can't have a grid.
Yeah, and it's been said about progressive enhancement over and over too. That, you know, when in order to build in this way, we have to lower ourselves to sort of a lowest common denominator sort of approach that punishes the higher end.
Seems like a big misunderstanding.
I think so, but I mean, I think Noah's right to point out that there's a certain design trend going on. I'm not sure it has much to do with responsive design so much as just the reality of, you know, the number of devices that we're designing for right now is, I think that's at the forefront of our focus, right? Just making things usable, across all these interfaces is, it's an incredible task in itself. So I don't know if that's contributing to the actual, you know, the visuals of a particular UI, perhaps. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't go so far as to blame the tool.
People always seem angry at the web for not being like some other design medium or some other technology.
Right. Yeah. And you'd think, I think at least with responsive design, we've really started to see the web sort of embrace its own medium.
Yeah.
You know, which it always was, this fluid thing, but we were always fighting it. And I think we're just starting to embrace it. And maybe that's, maybe that's why, you know, we're seeing some backlash now. It doesn't look like the web of old, you know.
But it's frustrating. It's I think it takes tremendous creativity to make something that's going to keep looking good regardless of the window. Keep
working, right?
It's like designing a film that's going to be viewed, you know, at every different imaginable aspect ratio.
Exactly.
What do you put in the frame, and how do you, you know, how do you control the experience? How do you make sure that you're giving a good experience? I think that's a lot of creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, beyond the visuals, making things function appropriately across different input mechanisms. You know, we talk a lot about touch versus mouse, but there's
right.
sometimes both of those are in play, or
right.
You know, there are all sorts of different input mechanisms we have to care about now, like device sensors.
And the fact that there's touch doesn't mean there isn't hover.
Right. Nothing's hover is, yeah, that's it.
Nothing's that's reliable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even, you know, many, many touch screens don't support touch events. So you get mouse events, even though if someone touched the screen, and you can't really make presumptions, I guess, is really the direction we're headed, right?
Have you played with the Surface or with any of the new Windows stuff, and where the screen is a touch surface, but it's in a desktop, you know, it's on a desktop computer?
I actually haven't had a chance to use. Have you used them yet?
I've just watched people use them.
Yeah.
I've touched them a little, but I haven't, and not enough to.
But, yeah, we had one in the office in the early days, but I think it was a tablet. It was before they released the laptop version of it. So.
To me, it feels like an accessibility experiment in a way, or accessibility problem in a way. Moving my hands from one position to another, sort of looking at the screen as this object that I'm controlling with keys and a mouse, and then moments later looking at it as a touch surface.
Right.
And my wrist going back and forth. I find it a little bit, I'm sure someone will figure out how to make it work beautifully, but right now it feels a little camely, a little unwieldy.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, that's certainly influencing UI design, in that all of the menus and all the, you know, little finicky controls that worked well with a mouse pointer are sort of too small these days. I think it was a recent Chrome update that Chrome, the browser, had all of its menus just sort of gain a bunch of padding all of a sudden. And then the Chromebook came out like a week later, no surprise. So
there's also the fact that, you know, if it's a touch device, you want the nav on the bottom, because that's where you can really access it with your thumbs. And if it's a desktop, you sort of want it on the top, out of the way, like this sort of, right, like this ledge that you can ignore, but you know where to look up to it when you need it.
Right.
Those two modes are not compatible. So.
Right. At least not at once. Right. Yeah.
What's your feeling about, REST, or, you know, responsive and server side in some kind of combination?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I guess this would be an area where I'd avoid to blame a particular tool for, you know, being the right thing or the wrong thing for an approach. I know in-house at Filament, we haven't found a whole lot of need for server side help in dividing you know, the application of a particular interface or feature in that way.
What do you use, if not server-side? JavaScript?
Yeah, typically. Trying to think of... Well, I guess, you know, one common use case of REST would be to include, say, a fragment of HTML in one place or another in the document, depending on the size of the screen or something. And the benefit there is clear, that anything that you can serve, you know, let the server provide up front in a way that's already sort of accurate or correct for the device is going to be slightly faster. So that's great. What we've found is, in the last year or two, particularly with we're now using M's for media queries, right? So the breakpoints are of a design are very driven by user preference, even like the font size or the zoom level that the browser is currently set to, will drive the actual placement of the elements on the page and the design that's in play. So if I bumped my font size up on my laptop enough, it would actually demand a layout similar to what you would get by default on a small phone. And in that way, it's becoming very hard to predict or presume very much from the server until you can actually deliver the assets and inspect what's really going on the client side and say, okay, now we're really informed. We can make an accurate judgment call about where to place a particular element. So in that case, circling back to including the fragment in one place or another, we've been, using CSS to do that, either through positioning or I guess Flexbox would be like an evolution of how we will address that without the server in the coming years anyway, even if it's not quite ready yet, although it's close, right?
Aren't there JavaScript helpers that let you use absolutely. Flexbox as if all the browsers support it?
Yeah, well, I guess there's a polyfill, although I haven't played with it much. I think Chris Coyer wrote a post on it recently that demonstrated the current state of the art with using Flexbox across browsers really consistently. And I think IE9 was really where it fell apart, right? So you needed a polyfill there. I haven't played with it. One thing we've been using in-house, like we used on the Boston Globe, actually, is there were a few parts of the Boston Globe site where a particular layout just wasn't going to be possible with floats because we were sort of handcuffed by source order. Mm-hmm. So we developed a small JavaScript approach that would append an element to one place or another in the DOM based on whatever breakpoint was in play.
And why is JavaScript preferable to server side there?
Well, for us, we needed this to happen not only when the page was served, but also if the user happened to change the orientation of their device. A different breakpoint would apply, and in our case, we were moving an advertisement around on a wider screen. It needed to be top right and sort of a little down the page, right after flowing content. So we couldn't use absolute positioning very easily. And then on the mobile layout, it was very high up in the mix because the client wanted users to see the ad pretty soon as they were scrolling down the page, right? So in order to achieve that layout, we were using JavaScript to append it around. The technique actually we released is called append around.
How many different little tools like that have you guys at Filament Group released to the community through GitHub or through?
Yeah, well, we've tried to put out there really all of the little snippets that are generic and useful to us. Because we've just seen, our clients and ourselves really gain, in addition to the community from having another tool that they can fork or, fix to their own needs. Our own clients benefit a lot from once something is open sourced, we get all this help, right? The community jumps on and says, oh, I found a bug in this browser. Here's a fix.
Right.
I think it's becoming more and more sort of just a critical part of our development process to do this whenever we can, because it's becoming untenable to test every device, right?
How do you come up with your names? Like,
that's the most fun
part. Essential, which was like extender.
That would have been a bad name in hindsight, but essential. Yeah.
Essential. What about picture, right. Picture fill, polyfill?
Yeah, picture fill. Yeah, right.
For those not knowing, for those who aren't familiar, it's an approach to responsive images.
Right. Right. It sort of mimics the picture element, which is now a it's in the standards, which is great. First public working draft now. It mimics that with divs, I was going to say.
The W3C's draft or the what working group's draft?
W3C, yes. Yeah. And they also just published a source set.
Do they? Right. The same way. And that's the what working group or both?
The W3C just published both in the last week, sort of as they're not really competitor specs so much as I think they're still looking for ways to make them work really well together.
Why would you need both? Is it like a political, we couldn't solve this, so take your choice?
Well, I think there are some advantages that people see to both, and actually being able to combine them might be the best solution of all. Source set has a really nice, concise approach to specifying images for different pixel densities. So HD screens versus standard definition kind of screens. It's very simple syntax to specify those versus using media queries, which we can actually already use to target those screens. So I think I sort of see source set as a nice, like a syntactic sugar, I guess, on top of media queries, like just a little, you know, a nicety.
Okay.
To something we probably can already do. But, you know, there are varying opinions on that. I think one extension to source set, which I'm not actually sure is in the W3C spec or not, allows you to specify viewport widths as well as device densities. So you can say this image should apply when the viewport is 800 pixels wide, that sort of thing. So in that way, it's very, it sort of competes with media queries, I think. So one could be accepted and not another.
You probably wouldn't want to do that, though, when you're designing with M's in media queries.
Yeah, well, I think that's a major fallback to the source set syntax, is that it sort of implies pixels. Mm-hmm. It's a W suffix, so you say 800W or 500H for height, rather than a M or pixel or, you know, any other CSS unit that you might be used to using. So, yeah, I'm not sure I would find a whole lot of use for that because the rest of our layout is already written in flexible units. So it would be hard to pair, I guess.
What do you do when the user has, there are some Android devices where the user can redefine a pixel in a way you didn't anticipate? Do your flexible units kind of work around that, or do you ever have... I mean, in the old days, people were trying to use M's before all this complexity. Many of us tried to use M's just to avoid creating accessibility problems for people in browsers that didn't scale. But then we found when people change their default font size, which admittedly not many people do, but for those who do, if they shrank it, your text could become illegible. So, you know, it's a case of you're trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. But you're still hurting some user. How much of your time is spent? And again, you're much more in the trenches with this stuff than I am these days. I'm, you know, just sort of watching now more than experimenting with these kinds of things. How much of your time is spent just going, oh, didn't expect that. All right.
Yeah, quite a lot.
How big is your test suite? Let me put it another. Test suite?
Well, we're fortunate. At Filament Group, we work on the jQuery mobile project. We actually lead it. And as a result, we have access, or we actually house the whole testing lab, the device testing lab for jQuery mobile, which is loads of devices. I'm not even sure how many at last count, but I think there are, you know, over 70 when I was there last.
And how do you send your content to all of them at once? What tool do you use for that?
I'm not sure we've had a lot of luck with automating the physical testing, just because they're so they're hard to stay. They're hard to keep charged, for one.
Right.
And they're hard to keep the browser up and, you know, from going to sleep. And then many of the browsers or many of the devices are just impossible to keep on. You know, they have their own sleep timers. And
when they're plugged in.
I think so. Although I'm not sure. So since I actually work remotely now, but since I've been in Boston, we built a new unit, I guess, to house all of the devices and keep them plugged in all at once, which was something we really needed when I was there. So I'm not really sure if maybe that solves some of that.
And then what? Do you have like a servant or a remote servant that you call, like Jeeves?
Yeah, interns.
Interns, Jeeves. Okay, so not Jeeves, but like what? Duncan.
Right.
Duncan.
Andrew.
Andrew.
Yeah.
How do people become, for people who are salivating at the thought of working with you guys, how do people become interns at the Filament Group?
Yeah, we've had a couple interns in the past couple of years, and we just post about it on Twitter typically. I don't think we've done any more formal of a job posting than that, but we've got a great response from that. And man, we found some excellent help.
Help an old man's ignorance. What's the difference between polyfill and shim?
I don't know if there is a difference.
Good. Whew. That's a close one. How did you get involved with jQuery? What's the whole history of that?
Wow. Yeah. So I think it was the first jQuery conference, which was called jQuery Camp at the time. That I attended, and I just sort of had this, sort of vague interest in the library at the time. And, I think that was it. I met John Rezig there at a meetup afterwards. And I think I was using MooTools at the time, something along those lines, or Prototype. And he told me about what they were working on, and I got really interested. Early on, I was just involved as a designer to help them out. So I designed the jQuery logo, for instance, and the early websites, things like that. Thankfully, they've got a much fuller design team these days that handles all of that. So,
but the logo is still yours.
It is, yeah. The original logo was a Devo hat. You remember that?
But a Devo hat, but it also kind of looks AT&T-ish in a way.
Yeah, so the earliest logo was a red Devo hat that was just sitting upright, and we actually we had to change it, but the whole thing was new wave JavaScript, so it was like this, you know, a play off the Devo thing.
That's so fun.
Yeah. Yeah, so once, you know, I'm not sure what drove the redesign, but we wanted to sort of make a logo that kept that spirit, but was a little more subtle.
Right, a little more abstract.
So that's what the current logo is. It's a Devo hat on its on a different plane, so to speak. But it kind of looks like a signal too. I get that.
Have you seen the CSS, all CSS renditions of it using border radius?
Are there those?
Like Chrome, Safari, Firefox, yeah. IE9 and up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was fun being involved early on. That's what really got me excited about JavaScript in the first place. And
have you named any parts of of jQuery?
No, I don't think I have.
Or did you come up with any slogans?
Well, they always had that write less, do more slogan. Yeah, I can't claim that. But
that's not you, and they can't really top that.
They haven't changed it.
Why would they? Yeah, no, why would they?
It's good.
A while back, a friend was talking about a list apart from people who make websites maybe changing its logo, because after all, we make apps and all this other stuff now, but... To me, it was kind of like
it's all websites,
and also it has so much heritage now. To me, it'd be like, yeah, that Morton Salt girl, that's kind of sexist, and why is it raining? Rain is depressing, and let's get rid of the umbrella. I mean, you know, I don't mean to make fun. I mean, I think all these questions are worth asking, but mm-hmm. I kind of, maybe I just love to hold on to things, but I, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I love the distinction slogan. Between a website and a web app is kind of, difficult to, well, I'm it not is. Even sure if right. what it is really.
Right. So if it's a poetry ring, well, even if it's, you know, collected poems of Emily Dickinson, it's still an application that lets you read the poems, right? Lets you browse the poems. So
yeah. any website that has a simple HTML form is some form of application.
It's interesting though, because, right, HTML5, although it's just HTML now, but when it was called HTML5, I mean, there was a big deal made about it was the first HTML for a world of apps.
Right.
And yet, it's kind of always been a web of apps.
Yeah, I think so.
As soon as you could hit a radio button, that was an app.
Right. Or even if it was just an article, I guess that could be a reading experience. That's an app. So
what?
Yeah.
So
hard to define.
what is getting you excited now? What are you working on that's secret that you can sort of hint at or come out mm-hmm. with?
I don't know if there are any secrets I can share. I know we're working on some pretty exciting client projects that should launch very soon.
You do client projects and you write and you do sharing with the community via GitHub and jQuery. Any interest in creating a product?
Well, I think Filament has always had, a pretty firm interest and stance on client services work, as opposed to focusing on one product. I think all of us sort of agree that that we like the churn of client services work. We like something,
right.
a new challenge every so often. I mean, personally, I've in my spare time, I've developed products just for fun. I built a web application called Write Maps a number of years ago that was sort of like a site planning tool, create site maps, things like that. It's actually under new ownership now. But
is it Amazing Maps for a Better Perspective, Write Maps series?
That is not it.
That's not it.
Write with a W, like writing.
Oh, write.
Yeah, writemaps.com. Yeah, and it's it's for planning website hierarchies.
Right? You sold this?
I did. Yeah. So
how did you do?
I'm very happy with how I did.
Okay, good.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm actually, I'm really happy to see it to see it take off again. Hopefully, under a new owner, because I just had no time to keep up with it.
Of course, I get very tired of this myself, but I'm going to indulge in it. Ironically, their site's not responsive.
Sorry. Yeah, well, I'm just kidding. I'll take the blame for that.
I'm just kidding. No, I mean, yeah. Exactly.
No, this was built in
2004?
5 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
The original. Yeah. So,
back in the 60s.
Yeah, but as far as I know, it's in development again to make a new version, which is pretty exciting.
This is your design, right?
And it is, yeah.
And that logo is yours also.
Yeah, I'm looking it up now just to make sure it hasn't changed. But yep, that's all.
And look at the favicon. Yeah. Very nice. So, yeah. How do you? How much design do you get to do? Not experience, not code, but visual right. design, graphic design, whatever you want to call it these yeah. days.
Well, currently I'm probably about 90%. Design actually in client work
in the browser or in Photoshop or what?
It's interesting. We've been trying, especially with our active clients right now, we've been trying to, we always start in Illustrator, which was something new to me, for layout work for the web mm-hmm. anyway. Used to do all the vector artwork and things like that in Illustrator, but to do layout in Illustrator was something new when I came to Filament. And mm-hmm. took me a little while actually to get used to it.
I would never have worked with Jason Santa Maria if I'd been familiar with it. I had the same experience as you. I used Illustrator for the thing, you know, to make a logo. That was all.
Yeah. Right.
Jason came in to solve it when I was working on a project with Doug Bowman. Doug got hurt his back, couldn't finish the project. Mm-hmm. Jason came in because he'd written about designing in Illustrator. I was like, oh, that guy knows the tool.
Yeah. I think it's great because at least internally, we tend to have one document that has pretty much every variation of our layouts across the whole site, just in one gigantic canvas.
We
use a lot of symbols, I guess, in Illustrator to the global navigation would be a symbol. And if you dig into it, then the logo is a symbol. And these are nice because you can edit it in one place and it sort of ripples through all of the designs.
How do you, in Illustrator, so let's imagine, I'm sure you've seen this before, we've got a responsive site and there's a nav at the top, maybe some tabs, right, mm-hmm. in a desktop view. And that nav's going to move to the bottom maybe in a smaller, in a more handheld world.
Right.
How do you do that in Illustrator?
Well, I'm not sure we found, maybe it's possible. I'm not sure we have any automated ways to approach that in a sort of.
No, I mean, how do you show it? Do you have like symbols? Do you have arrows in Illustrator?
Yeah, we would typically have a different variation of the nav for the footer, for the header.
Right.
Those are all symbols that we could share across, at least across all of the comps that reflect a particular width breakpoint kind of thing. So yeah, there's some sharing. I've heard like Upstatement, for example, who worked with us on the Globe project, they use InDesign for all of their design work. And I'm waiting to get a tutorial from Tito over there because I think there's a lot of potential for that, especially with InDesign's use of external text and being able to reflow text across.
And style sheets, like in Quark.
Columns, things like that. Yeah, really.
Styles instead of going, I'm going to set some type now and try to emulate the way I set it a moment ago for another column.
Right, right. So I don't have much experience there, but I'm thinking of moving that way whenever I get some time to learn something new. But anyway, cool. Yeah, more of a design focus as of late for me. But typically, before the project I was working on, or I am working on right now, I was probably on the other side, almost 100% development for a couple of years. So,
and you're taking responsive design. That's your shtick right now, as you said. You're sort of taking that on the road, sharing it with audiences. Will we see a book or anything like that coming up in the future? Perhaps?
Not sure how to answer that.
Okay.
I'm in the process of thinking about such a thing.
That sounds like it would be interesting at some point.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Well, we might have to have you back again. Yeah. I think we should wrap because we've been rapping so long. I want to thank you for taking a lot of time out of your busy day.
Oh, of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure. And tomorrow, there'll be another hour of you on Event of Parts website.
Oh, yes.
That'll be cool.
A video from Boston, right?
Video from Boston. Your current hometown. So that'll be cool. So thank you very much, Scott Gell. Thank you, Filament Group. Thank you, Lynda.com, for sponsoring today's show. Thanks, Lynda.com. And thank you, listeners and friends. We'll see you again.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye. Right,
thanks, Jeffrey.